Good evening once again. Welcome to Bodhi Commons lecture series. Before we start, a few words about Bodhi Commons. Bodhi Commons is a left and progressive bilingual website in English and Malayalam. We are run entirely by volunteers. We have been publishing articles on various socio-political issues, specifically from the position of the left, under the Creative Commons license since 2010. You can find us at the address bodhicommons.org and on our social media handles on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today's lecture will be delivered by Professor Madhura Swaminathan on the topic COVID-19 pandemic and food security. Madhura Swaminathan is professor and head at the Economic Analysis Unit, Indian Statistical Institute, Bangalore. She is also the honorary chairperson of the M.S. Swaminathan Research Foundation. She was a member of the Government of India's high-level panel on long-term food security. She works on issues pertaining to food security, agriculture, and rural development. She has published several research articles and books, particularly on rural India, the details of which I am not going to give at the moment, but the interested readers may take a look at the website of Foundation for Agrarian Studies, of which Professor Madhura Swaminathan is a trustee. Her most recent article in The Hindu, titled Shift to Upscaling Food Rationing Now, deals with the question of providing for millions who were struck hard by the unplanned and sudden lockdown. She argued for measures to immediately ensure universal rationing with an expanded food basket and special measures for cooked food in urban areas for the vulnerable population. Welcome, Madhura, to Bodhi Commons lecture series. Today's event is in this format. We shall have a 40 to 45 minutes of seminar by Madhura and then 15 minutes of Q&A followed by it. Please do check out Bodhi Commons website, and if you are interested in contributing to the website in terms of articles through any other means, please reach out to any of us. Now over to Madhura for the lecture.
So I'm going to talk about COVID-19 and food security in India, but I think it's very important to start with what was the situation before COVID-19. We were not really in a very happy situation even before this happened. So I think that's very important. A large part of my lecture, I'm going to start with what is the status of food security in India, and then come to what has happened after in the last month or so, after the pandemic spread to India. So let me start with the definition of food security. Food security at the individual, household, national, regional, and global levels is achieved when all people at all times have physical and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to meet their dietary needs and food preferences. This is the definition of the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, FAO. It's rather long, but I think there are just two critical parts here that we should keep in mind. And the first one is that ultimately food security is about individuals, about every woman, every man, every child. Food security has to be, each person has to have adequate quantity and quality of food. That's what the second part says. Now, in order to reach an individual, reach a child, you may have to go through a family. Different regions of India produce different foods. So we need some food security at the state or regional level. We need national food security, and I'll come to that when we talk about COVID. So we can talk about food security at a global level, at a national level, but all these strategies or all these higher levels of food security have one objective, which is that no individual should be food insecure. No individual should go to bed hungry. No individual should starve. No individual should be malnourished. So if this is our goal, what was the situation, pre-COVID situation? As you know, we don't have nowadays, we don't have very good statistics in recent years, but I'll just give you a few numbers from as recent as I can get, which show you that India holds the world record for malnutrition. If we take the children below the age of 5 who are wasted in that their normal, their weight for age is below the normal weight for age, it's usually 2 standard deviations below the median, 36% of children in India were malnourished. 50% of pregnant women had anemia. Another indicator, which is again for 2015-16, is the body mass index. That is the weight divided by height square. And again, about 20% of men and 23% of adult women had a body mass index which showed severe malnutrition. So we can go on in this way. I can give you more indicators in terms of calorie intake. Let me give one more in terms of protein intake. In 2005, the average protein intake per person in India was 48 grams per day, whereas the recommended allowance, dietary allowance, was 60 grams. Now, some of us consume much more than that 48 gram. We have meat and fish and eggs and dal. So actually, the proportion who are getting below the norm is going to be even much higher. So what I'm trying to say is, be it in terms of calories, be it in terms of micronutrients like iron deficiency, which leads to anemia, be it in terms of protein, on almost all the parameters by which we measure malnutrition and food insecurity, India has one of the highest incidence of malnutrition in the world. And when we say 30% of the population or 40% of the population, that's 500 million people or more. So it's a huge problem of food insecurity that we are already, the situation in which we're already. The paradox that is often talked about in India is that we have this huge problem of hunger and malnutrition, and at the same time, we have record food grain production. Last year, the food grain production was about 283 or almost 300 million tons. And food grain here means cereals and pulses. So rice, wheat, all other cereals like millets and maize, and all the dals and pulses that we have. So we have record food grain production, but we continue to have very, very large millions of people, hundreds of millions who are malnourished. Now, since this was a problem even before COVID came along, what was it that was being done in India? What was the food policy that addressed this problem of food insecurity or of hunger and malnutrition? In fact, I should call it chronic hunger. Not so much as, you know, acute starvation, but chronic hunger. Now, the policies and the institutional structure for addressing food security in India today is one that was actually established in the 1960s. We had a crisis in the mid-60s when we had to import 10 million tons of wheat from the US. It was called a ship-to-mouth existence, in that people would have gone hungry if we didn't get, if the ship sat and arrived with the grain. So in that crisis actually led to a formalization of the structure of food security. And I think there's a very important point which I want to come back to later, that the crisis today, the pandemic, you know, maybe there's a lesson in terms of how we need to change our policies of food security. So the crisis of the 1960s led to the institutionalization of a system of food security, which started from the producer or the cultivator and went up to the consumer, the final, the individual. So you had a system, the system of procurement and minimum support price that many of you are aware of. That system, although weakened, still exists. So that was set up. The Food Corporation of India was set up in order to undertake this procurement with the help, of course, of different agencies in different states. Transport and storage of this food was arranged through various food storage storage corporation, through the Indian Railways. And then finally, the network of fair price shops was strengthened and expanded. It existed even earlier, but it was actually expanded in the 1960s. So today we are all hearing about supply chain and, you know, value chain and all that. But actually, it was very forward-looking that in the mid-60s, you had a set of institutions which started from the producer, giving inputs and input subsidies to the producer, then procuring, then storing, then transporting, and taking it to the furthest corners of the country through the network of ration shops. And this was, of course, something that was initiated at the central government, but in which the state governments, as we'll see again, state governments have a very important role to play in food security. So this is the context that I want to give. That's very important to understand food security today. Now, from the 19, let me add one more sort of background and then we'll come to today. The second major change in food policy in India, so it was strengthened and whole structures and institutions were established in the mid-60s, well thought out policy, continued in that way, expanded till the early 1990s. So the next big set of changes or attempts to change was in 1991. And I think this is again something very important that we must think about, because if liberalization had proceeded as was advised by many, by the World Bank and many others and many economists, Indian economists too, we would be in real trouble today. So in 1991, when policies of liberalization and privatization became popular, how were the policies of food security and the institutions set up to implement those policies, how were these affected? So let me give you a few examples. There was a very big debate about the privatization of the Food Corporation of India. FCI is inefficient, FCI is corrupt, FCI is wasteful, the private sector is much better. And there was a big debate on privatization. Luckily, that didn't take place and the FCI has remained, which is now playing a huge role in terms of actually giving grain to different state governments, because FCI has branches in different parts of the country. Another big debate at that time was to weaken the Indian Railways to transfer the movement of grain in different parts of the country from the railways to the roadways. Again, various arguments were made that roadways are faster, they're more efficient because they're point to point, railways are charging more. But again, you can see that this was also a debate between the public and the private. And again, to a large part, this was also prevented and the distribution of grain remained the responsibility of the Indian Railways. The third debate was on doing away with the minimum support price and procurement altogether. And this debate is actually one that has been continuing till very recently. The privatization of FCI and the shift from roadways to railways was somewhat addressed, and I think people realized it was not possible. But the debate on MSP and procurement has continued to this day, because this is seen as an intervention in the market, and it's argued that it's better by the neoliberal economists, that it's better for the market to play a role and government should not be interfering in market functioning by either setting a price or by actually buying grain. As you know, the MSP as a result of this has actually not grown in the last few years, has not kept up with the rate of increase in input costs and input prices and so on. But anyway, all these changes could not be brought about for several reasons. One of them, of course, most important, I think, is the political pressure, particularly from the left during the UPA regimes, which kind of slowed down or prevented this wholesale liberalization and privatization of these very important institutions. One measure, however, was implemented, and that was the narrow targeting of the public distribution system. So in 1996-97, there was a shift from what was universal rationing and public distribution system, that is, all households with a registered address had access to a ration card and then could buy certain quantities of commodities. But the targeting, the idea of separating or distinguishing between below poverty line and above poverty line and very, very poor Antyodaya and so on, this idea actually, unfortunately, took root in the mid-90s. Although it's very important here, and I'll come back to that in the end, it's very important to say that the implementation of the policy of the public distribution system is very much in the hands of the state governments. So many state governments, Kerala, Tamil Nadu, more recently Chhattisgarh, have gone against the tide in the sense that they've gone against what was prescribed by the central government as policy. But nevertheless, the changes at the center are very important because they are linked to the financial allocation that the central government is going to make. So finally, all this, the liberalization and the weakening of the public distribution system, the targeting, leads up to the National Food Security Act in 2013. So in between the liberalization of the 90s and the 2013, you have, of course, period of agrarian crisis in India. The late 90s, 1998 to 2004, is now established to be one of the worst periods for the agrarian economy of India. And it was in sort of in response to this growing distress that during the UPA 2 regime, this National Food Security Act was ultimately passed and legislated on in September 2013. So it made access, right to food. So every individual has a right to a certain quantity and quality of food at affordable prices. So this is now a part of our legislation. And the coverage, now I'm going to spend a few minutes on the coverage of the National Food Security Act. Let me tell you who is covered in the National Food Security Act. The coverage of the Food Security Act, although many of us argued that it should be universal. In other words, every citizen of India should have a right to this adequate food. But unfortunately, this was watered down a little bit, and the right has been given to up to 75% of the rural population and 50% of the urban population. So 75% of rural population and 50% of urban population are actually what are called priority or eligible within the National Food Security Act. And the 5 kilograms of food grain per person per month, they are eligible for that. And the certain prices were fixed. Rupees 3 for rice, 2 for wheat, and 1 for millets. Now, I want to spend a little time now on this question of targeting and who should be in the target group. How was it decided that 75% of, rural households are eligible, or 50% of urban households? Now, earlier when targeting was introduced, it was on the basis of a sort of poverty line, which is a sort of an imaginary line and not really linked to food security at all. So shouldn't the criterion of who should be eligible, not just for the NFSA, but for rations today, and that's why I think this is a very important point and I want to spend a few minutes on it. Who should be eligible for access to cheap food? Now, instead of using a poverty line, on which, as you all know, we don't have regular surveys for the last 10 years, we don't have data on incomes, why not use a criterion which relates to food and food expenditure? And this criterion is called the food share. Food share is nothing but the share of the family budget that you spend on food. So if your monthly income is 10,000 rupees and you spend 7,000 on food, and by food I mean all types of food, including beverages and fruits and vegetables and sweets and everything, if you spend 7,000 rupees, then your food share is 70%. You're spending 7,000 out of 10,000 on food. Now, this is a criterion which is actually used in the United States to identify households eligible for food subsidy. I'll come to that again because I want to talk a little bit about Trump's COVID package. The United States of America has the largest food security program in the world. It's not India. We may think we have a large program. It's called the food stamp program, and it's a system where households are given these stamps, like our milk coupons, and you can go to grocery stores and you can buy food for the value of those stamps. Now, during the recession following the financial crisis of 2008, 1 in 6 American families, 1 in 6 American families was dependent on the food stamp. And I'm sure now in COVID-19, it's going to go up. And that's why there's been a big allocation for food stamps. But let me come to this. So what is the criterion that the United States uses to identify families eligible for the food stamp? The criterion is that you spend more than 1/3 of your family expenditure, by the way, not income, it's expenditure, family budget or expenditure, on food. Okay, so let me put it differently. If in India you have a family spending 10,000 rupees a month on all their expenses, on rent, on transport, on fuel, on movies, all the things that a family spends on, if you're spending more than 30%, that is, if you're spending more than 3,000 a month on food in the United States, you would be eligible for food stamps. Sorry, not 30, 33%, so 3,300. So let us look at the data on India. And if we apply this criterion, the US criterion, to Indian expenditure patterns, and the latest data I have for about 2010-11, because as all of you know, we don't have any consumer expenditure survey after that. 17-18 results have not been made public because they're showing a very bad situation. If you take the 2010 data, then only 5% of rural households and 25% of urban households would be considered not eligible for food stamps. Let me repeat it in another way. Going by the US criterion in 2011, and I think the situation would be worse in 2017-18, if at all, 95% of rural Indians and 75% of urban Indians would be eligible for the food stamp. So I think I want to, I know there's a lot of numbers, but I want to leave this point with you because when we have any scheme, it's very important to know who is the target group. If 95% of households have to be reached, should I spend all my time and money and effort trying to find those 5% and eliminating them? Or should I spend my time and money and effort on reaching the 95%? So this is the difference. This is what makes the difference between a targeted and a universal program. When the target group is very large, in fact, the target group today in India is the majority of the population, 95% of rural households and 75% of urban, and this is in 2010, this is a 2010 data. In 2017-18, some data that was leaked showed that the average per capita expenditure has gone down in India. So even before COVID hit us, there seemed to have been a worsening in poverty, a worsening in household expenditure. So that would have anyway raised the people who should be eligible. And of course, now we have COVID-19. So the point to make here is that when you're in almost 90-95% of your population is food insecure, then the emphasis should be on a universal program so that we make sure that nobody is wrongly excluded, not a targeted program where you're concerned about who are the people, the 5% of rich in rural areas, the 20% of rich in urban areas, who probably don't even use their ration cards, but we spend a lot of time and administrative cost on identifying and excluding them. So I think this is very important that in the situation we are in today, we must not go for targeted programs, especially in relation to food security. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So let me turn now to the COVID-19 crisis. Now, we don't need data. We know that all employment has come to a standstill, that there's massive unemployment. Except farming and fishing, even fishing has stopped except farming and some livestock related dairying. In urban areas, every sector of employment, every sector of the economy is under lockdown. In other words, there's zero employment. Now, the important point here is that 90% of India's workforce is in what we call the informal sector. In fact, the numbers in the informal sector may be even larger. Let me step back for a minute. What is the formal and the informal sector? The difference, the key difference between formal and informal is not the size of the enterprise, not whether it's in being undertaken in a home or in a factory, not even the number of employees, but it is whether there is regulation of the enterprise or activity. So if you're a lawyer and you're working from home, that doesn't make you informal if you are an income taxpayer. So your incomes are known to the government and you're reporting them and you're paying taxes on them. So I think this is a very important point because there's very often a confusion between what is formal and informal. It's not necessarily a self-employed person. So you could have a self-employed dhobi or ironing man who's clearly in the informal sector, and you can have a self-employed lawyer or private tutor who's in the formal sector. Now, over the last 20 years, and again, this is something to do very closely linked with liberalization, is that the regulation of the labor market or the regulation of wages, of working conditions, of social security benefits, all these have come under attack on the ground that in order to have higher economic growth, higher industrial growth, you need flexibility in the labor markets, you need freedom to hire and fire, and Indian industry has always been held back because it is subject to too many labor regulations. So you've had a huge weakening of labor regulations over the last 10 years. I'm not an expert on that, I'm not going to go into it. But as a result of which, more and more people, we already had a large majority in the informal sector, but more and more workers, even within the formal sector, so even with those working in factories, are very often on temporary and precarious work contracts with very little or no social security benefits. In other words, when there's no demand in a garment factory, the workers are told to go home the next day. There's no continuity of employment. There may be some meager benefits in medical and so on, but there's definitely no security of employment. So almost our entire workforce, 90% of our workforce has been overnight, has become unemployed and has lost income. And very few of them, even if some of them will get back jobs when the economy recovers, during this period of closure, they have no access to incomes. Now, it doesn't take too much, it doesn't require any calculation to say that there's going to be a huge increase in poverty. So we already have a massive problem of food insecurity. We have 400 or 500 million people who are malnourished, and we have, you know, almost 90% of the population, 80-90% of the population who are food insecure. And now we have a massive rise in poverty because complete lack of employment and lack of incomes. Now, in this situation, and here I want to go back to this definition of food security before talking about what has been done in India and what needs to be done. Food security, when I say that 30%, when you spend 30% or more on income, you're food insecure. 3 months ago, somebody might have said, no, that's not a that definition. The definition is based on the fact that any small change in income will have a huge impact on food. And that's exactly what we're saying. If you were spending the bulk of your 10,000 on food and now you have zero, then clearly we don't need much of calculation to say that you are going to be hungry and very soon you're going to be desperate and starving. Now, since the arrival of COVID-19, what has the central government announced? The central government announced about 10 days ago, at the end of March, announced a 1.75 lakh crore package. This is, I'll only talk about the components of food security, but this package is of many things, and the food measures are only a small part of this package. But I think it's worth thinking about this number for a minute. This is 0.8% of GDP, 0.8%, so less than 1% of our GDP. Now, I want to go to Trump's package for a minute, because what has really been amazing about many countries in Europe, and particularly the United States of America, is that they have, in this crisis, come out with huge support financial packages for the people. So the first package, which has been announced by Trump, is of $2.2 trillion, roughly, you know, about 167 lakh crores. So that's 100 times the package that India has announced. But what is a specific package which would have an immediate effect in terms of food security? One is an additional $15.5 billion for the food stamp program. $15.5 billion is about 75 crores. So the Trump administration has announced an additional 75 crores just for the food stamp program. And it's not just enough to have the food stamps. You need many other things in order to survive. So they have also announced $1,200, that is about 80,000 rupees, $1,200 per adult one-time handout, 500 per child, and 2,400 per couple, etc. So I think this is a kind of perhaps benchmark, that minimum benchmark that we should have, that we need in India both direct food transfers, we need transfers in kind, and we need cash transfers. So let me come to what needs to be done now. So as was mentioned at the start, some of these suggestions have been outlined in an article in The Hindu. Is the first thing is that, and I'm going to make a little distinction between rural and urban areas, because the whole system of ration cards is linked to households and to residences, places where people stay. So in rural areas, we must make the PDS universal. It's not just for priority households or non-priority households, it is for all households. The PDS must be made universal. The cereal transfer, that is only the rice, wheat, maize, the cereal transfer must be, quantity must be doubled. And why do I say that? Because the current quantity, which is part of the NFSA, the National Food Security Act, the current quantity is about half what the ICMR recommends per person. So a certain number of grams of cereal is recommended per person per day, and it is on that basis. But since now there is no other source of income and no other cereal, we cannot give half the quantity. We have to give the entire quantity. So all the rations of cereal must be doubled. And this is the first. The second is that it's not just enough to give rice and wheat. You have to give more commodities, at least pulses, oil, salt, and some spices if possible. And where available, eggs, vegetable, and milk. So for rural households, we need doubling of the cereal, we need an expanded food basket, and we need it to be given to all households. Now, is this, let me just say a word about, is this feasible, and then I'll go to the urban households. Now, the obvious question is, do we have so much of food grain and can we afford to do this? Now, as of March, the numbers that are available officially say that we have 70 million tons. A ton is 1,000 kg. We have 70,000 million kg of cereals in our stocks. So in terms of physical feasibility, there's absolutely no problem. Now, I want to just step back here for a minute. When this, in the 1960s, when this whole system was put in place of the food security system as we have it today, one of the very important objectives of policymakers was to ensure food sovereignty, was to say that for the major commodities that we require for consumption, given the size of our country, we cannot be dependent on the world food market. And today, when there's no global trade, I think perhaps we some of those who did not recognize the importance of this will now realize the importance of food sovereignty. I'm not saying that India has to produce every commodity in the world, but basic cereals and pulses, which we still rely on imports, these are something that we should be growing adequate quantities on average. So we have 70 million tons of cereal, so it's not going to be a problem if these quantities are doubled. And the wheat harvest is just starting in April in Punjab and Haryana and Western UP and Madhya Pradesh, so more stocks will be added very soon. And it's supposed to be a record wheat harvest this year. What about the financial feasibility? Now, this whole system of food security, which has been running all these years, did not ever exceed 1% of our GDP. And that includes all the expenses of the Food Corporation India and all the payment to the producers from whom the grain is procured. So it includes the cost of the railways, of the packaging, of the distribution. So we have never spent more than 1% of GDP. Now, when we say that 40-50% of our population is malnourished and 80-90% of them are today food insecure, is it a problem if that 1% becomes 2%? If we need to double our expenditure, that should be the minimum that we do. Let me quickly turn in the next couple of, in the urban areas, I think the rations, the same ration policy for those who have ration cards, it's not so easy to make it universal because there are a lot of migrant households, there are people staying in rented accommodation. So for the urban areas, in addition to the ration measures taken for the rural, we need to provide cooked food through schools, through colleges, and in different ways. Okay, I have a couple of minutes, so let me just make a few more points. In addition to the distribution in kind, which, as Deepak said, is detailed in the Hindu article, we must have cash transfers. The measly 500 rupee to women and the 2,000 of PM Kisan, which has been promised, is too little. A minimum of 5,000 rupees per family for all those with Jandhan accounts and BPL accounts, and 5,000 a month for 3 months should be announced. In fact, even the ration policy should be announced for 3 months so that people are not worrying about next month or the month after. They know that things are taken care of. Now, the last point I want to make is that while state governments are on the ground handling this, and many state governments are doing much more than the central government has promised. We have experience of Kerala, and then more recently, with Kerala leading, we have Tamil Nadu and Odisha, and many other states have come forward with better food distribution packages than announced by the state. But the funding, all state governments are facing a severe problem of funding, and therefore, it's very important that the central government expand the scale of funding for food security. The last point I want to make is that maybe this pandemic, this time, which is really a time of crisis and enormous suffering for vast majority of people, maybe this is a lesson that we need to ensure food security. We need to ensure not just a pittance in terms of 5 kilos of rice or wheat, but we need to ensure a nutritious food basket for all Indians. And there are many ways of doing it, but I think if we can bring about a change in our way of thinking about food security, and we can actually start addressing that huge problem of malnutrition in India, then maybe looking back on it, we'll say the pandemic, if things are done properly, the pandemic actually paved the way for a better food security policy for the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Madhura, for that insightful lecture. Now we will be taking questions.
How much will IMF and World Bank restrictions affected our food economy? So I think we, although in the early 1990s, when liberalization was started, as part of structural adjustment, the IMF and the World Bank were very keen that India's food subsidies be reduced. But because, I think very importantly, of our democratic setup, because of political opposition, we did not see the kind of drastic scaling back that was expected. We had the targeting, but we could keep our own policy and policy structure. Now, in this particular situation, I know the World Bank has granted aid to India. I'm not sure what terms and conditions of that are, but I think that in today's pandemic crisis, even the World Bank and the IMF recognize that, because food security is very much part of health security. If you're starving and hungry, you're much more vulnerable to infection and illness. So I think they're probably not going to come in the way of any Indian policy. So we can design our own policy. What about mass canteens, etc.? Is it advisable? Yes, Kerala is adopting home delivery. I think that to some extent, even the Delhi government announced that they will cook in canteens and they will distribute packets. In my view, we can have some kind of physical distancing for in the distribution of food. It's being done now in the places where migrant workers are sheltering. And I think this problem of physical distancing is going to remain for many months. So we have to find a way of addressing it. Yes, we can deliver to homes in rural areas, etc., or in certain urban clusters, but may not always be possible, particularly when we slowly start opening up the economy. Why is the contradiction about high reserves and so much hunger? Well, the contradiction is what I'm saying, that we have not given malnutrition and food security the kind of priority that should be given. We have not head-on addressed that problem. And that is why I'm saying that we had the huge problem to begin with. Now the problem is sort of like doubled or worsened. So maybe we can put in place a system now which will address the long-standing problems. A very important question is that about exclusion. Yes, in fact, I forgot to mention it, but not only should the ration distribution now be universal, it should not be based on any Aadhaar or any kind of other biometric identification. Because we know there are households which are waiting for new applications, this is a question being asked, or there are households where the migrant worker may be away and the biometrics may be in somebody else's name. So we should, as far as rural areas are concerned, I think, as in the case of Kerala, for example, if you can go through local panchayats, you can go through local institutions, there are only a limited number of households. I don't think we are going to have a big problem of what you call double fake people coming with ration cards or so on. Now, there's another question about should we rely on APMC or should we open our doors to private-public relations? Now, there are two things here. One is the sale of agricultural produce. Should all milk be sold to NDDB or to Karnataka or Tamil Nadu or Kerala milk cooperatives, or should there be private players? So I think that's one set of questions. The other is, should we have private players in our food security program, where we are trying to get a reasonable basket of food to people? And I think that it's very problematic to bring in private sector like Walmart or other MNCs, because as you can see, in times of crisis, it's Air India which is going and bringing Indians who are stranded abroad. It is the railways, Indian railways, who's taking the burden of transporting. So to expect a multinational to come in a time of crisis is very difficult. The second is that we have experience now. We have school meals in so many states. We have in some states like Karnataka, the school meal has been contracted out to Akshay Patra, and they're not giving eggs, they're not giving onion and garlic, they're giving what they think is the best package. So I think if we have certain norms which we are expecting for food security, ultimately it has to be the government. In terms of actual procurement, actual running of school meals or actual running, we have the private sector. The ration shop owners are private individuals. It is not a state government store in every little village. It's a private, it's like a franchisee who may sell other things, is a shopkeeper, but who takes on the ration. And when you are on a government contract, whether it is for ICDS or whether it is for rations, you have to follow certain government norms. In many countries in Canada, where a private supplier is having a government contract, there are certain conditions that have to be followed. And I think the same should apply in India. If we expand some of these schemes very quickly, we may require the private sector or the NGO sector to come in and help. But the terms and conditions, what is the food package to be given, what are the rates at which it has to be sold, these are something where the government will have to set the rules. Now, disruption of Rabi harvest, is it possible? Yes, I think it is possible. I don't think it's a problem in terms of having adequate food to distribute. As I said, we have 70 million tons, which is more than adequate. But it will be a problem if the Rabi harvest is disrupted and the food is not stored, then our reserves are going to be affected. And of course, all the producers who are selling that crop, all the cultivators, they're going to be affected in terms of income. Now, somebody has asked about security for jobs. As I said, a very small cash transfer has been announced and an increase in NREGA wage. But the kind of cash transfer, one-time cash transfer to all adults, men, women, and also for families with children, which has been announced in the United States, we do not have a unemployment or cash transfer program which has as yet been announced in India. In terms of the harvest, I think a question has come. I think it's very important that the government should announce right away that not just wheat, but all the other crops which are being harvested are going to be procured and at a certain price that needs to be announced. A remunerative price needs to be announced immediately. And I think that in this time, the supply chain has to be organized. In fact, it's very unfortunate that the lockdown was called without any planning, without actually organizing and defining what are essential services, without having permits for them. And I think without education, there are a lot of stories which come in the newspaper of essential supplies, including foods, which are being stopped at borders, which are being stopped within cities, which are being stopped at villages by vigilantes or by police. And this requires enormous awareness. We should be having a 1 hour every day on all television channels about how you go about what are the things that have to be allowed during the supply chain. So I think that this is this is feasible and has to be done. Supply chain has to be organized. Now, undocumented migrants, I don't know. I'm assuming that shelters that are being put up in different cities for migrant workers will include undocumented, and that we in this crisis, as far as food security, food and shelter is concerned, that we will not distinguish between documented and undocumented, between citizens and others. All those who are in India today, whether they have arrived as tourists, whether they're undocumented, whether they're migrants or workers, the same food security policy should apply to them. There's a question about food riots. I'm not sure. I think what is very sad, and what you know, pictures that one has seen in the media about families saying that they're more worried about dying of hunger than dying of COVID-19. And we have had, I'm not sure of the latest, more than 100 deaths of migrant workers and people who have been walking different parts of the country to reach their homes and with no access to food or water. So there's a tremendous amount of suffering, and I think this has to be addressed. And hopefully the government will address it before there's actually a riot-like situation. Now, I have, in the article which I have written in the Hindu, I've talked about the Chinese experience. Now, the Chinese shut down a whole city and district of 11 million people for more than 70 days, I think for about 76 days. And every day they organized the transport of rice, of flour, of noodles, of oils, of soya bean, of meat, of vegetables. So they actually identified places, provinces from where vegetables of different kinds, and they had a like a green corridor, which very often you heard about it in cities. Heart patients are taken through the green corridor. There are no blockages. So they did this. They brought every kind of food into Wuhan for 76 days. So I think I don't see why you know, it can't be done. So 163 deaths have been documented, as I'm just seeing. Now, what about the animal husbandry situation? There's a problem both in sale of meat and sale of milk. For some reason, there seems to be an idea that meat is associated with COVID-19 infection, perhaps because as of now, we think some of it may have originated in a market, wild market in China. But milk, as we saw pictures of, is being disposed of. Now, again, in some states, I know in Kerala and more recently in Karnataka, that milk is being supplied to the urban poor. So I think that we can, on the one hand, continue to buy milk from the milk producers so that their income remains. And the surplus milk, which is not being consumed because all restaurants, factories, hotels, etc., closed, that surplus milk can actually be distributed to people around the country. Somebody has mentioned about Jean. There is this article, yes, releasing food as well is very important, because what he says is the cash transfer is going to take time. Yes, because banks are not operating. They're operating with half the staff. Many of the ATMs in rural areas, I believe, are not functioning. They've not been refilled. So yes, getting cash is going to take longer. I agree with that. So we have to immediately first give the food basket. This makes it even more important. If people have no cash, they cannot even buy some chilies or some onion or some salt to go with the rice and wheat, which is going to be distributed. So we have to expand the food basket that is being distributed. I think if some of you look up, there's a there are 19 items in a kit that the government of Kerala is distributing. And I think we need something like that for till the time when cash transfers can actually reach people and they can get access to money to buy things that they go with your rice and your dal or your chapati. Now, yes, I think there are a lot of questions coming about supply chain, not just for food, but for milk, of how to ensure that. I think, again, you know, we've seen it in times. There have been natural disasters in India. There have been serious floods in Orissa. And if I remember, during the last major flood, Orissa was praised for having had shelters and for getting people. When the whole place is maroon, when you can't even get through, they managed to get food and water. So right now our roads are empty. There's no problem of quickly, probably the transport from place A to place B is going to take half the time it normally takes. So it's a question of planning, of actually having organizing at the district level, the panchayat level, and getting the supply chain working. So I don't think it's at all something which is difficult if it is organized. Now, people are all asking about what's the new normal for the city and so on. I think a very important point is that for procurement operations, as well as for running the PDS, we need financial support from the center. Now, I must add here that the central government announced a doubling of the ration, but they said only the increased ration would be free. They didn't say that the existing ration would be free. So they are expecting state governments to spend on buying the rations and on buying additional rations like Tamil Nadu or Kerala are doing, buying oil, buying sugar, buying salt. And I think the state governments are budgets are severely under strain, and there has to be a financial package. So maybe I just want to end again with this, that if we look at the US has 250 odd million people, and they are going to spend 75 lakh crores just on the food stamp program. We have about, I would say right now, we have about 1,000 million Indians who require food security. And the entire food package announced by the government of India, including the rations that they announced, is 1.75 lakh crores. So clearly we're talking, all the things we're talking about are not feasible unless the financial package is immediately increased and released to different states of India. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madhura. We are ending the session here. Thank you, Madhura, once again for the insightful lecture. And as mentioned in the lecture, we are in a grave situation where nearly 50% of our population are malnourished and 90% of our population are currently food insecure. The government has still not come up with a comprehensive plan to cover all these vulnerable populations.